Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage, episode number 21, brought to you by Chaos Group. We will be at FMX this week, so please come by if you're there and check us out. We've got some amazing presentations going on. We've got presentations from Morrow Images, from Machavision, from Lux Studios, Important Looking Pirates, and many more. So come by, check us out. If you can also check out everything that we'll be doing there by going to our website, which is going to be fmx2015.chaosgroup.com, and it'll be really cool to see you guys there. I will also be a speaker there, and I will be presenting the WikiHuman project, which I am extremely excited to do. We've got a lot of cool stuff to show off, and I'll be sharing that as well. And if you, I'd love to meet you guys if you're around, so come by and say hi and tell me if you enjoyed the podcast, tell me what you want to see, what you want to hear, and so forth. Anyway, to this episode. This episode features Ben West. Ben West is a really, really amazing and super nice guy. I mean, really charming person. I was very, very pleased to meet him. He is an artist, an ex-architect as well, surprise, surprise, and a director and creative director over at Framestore. And he has done some really great work. We speak about a lot of his projects and his history and his interesting past and the way his upbringing, as well as some really great stuff that he's done for a short called Fugu and Taco, which we will be putting a link up here. And he's been trying to get a graphic novel done of the short and extend that to possibly make an entire feature out of Fugu and Taco, which could be really cool. So I'm going to be putting all those links up there. So please follow through and check him out. And don't forget about his Kickstarter, which is pretty cool as well. Anyway, guys, thanks for listening and hopefully you enjoy it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I was looking at your IMDb on the bio in there, and it says that basically you were born in Sydney, but grew up in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
So, first of all, how long do you live in Papua New Guinea?
I lived in Papua New Guinea for about 4 years.
Okay.
I moved there when I was, I think it was third grade. And so we went through to, actually it would have been before third grade. And so I was at the end of my primary school, or I think it's elementary school in the States.
Yep.
So we were there for 4 years, and it was actually a really formative period of my life, because the one thing that was, I mean, apart from Papua New Guinea being quite a wild place and a frontier in many ways, I mean, it was, I think it's the last place on earth, that, there's a tribe that didn't have contact with people, you know, outside of their own community.
Right.
So it's a very, very unique place. And they speak something like 800 languages, and, you know, it's the house of 1,000 tribes. It's an incredibly dynamic country. But what was great about it was there was no kind of conformity. There was no expectations that you had to be a certain type of person or fit into a certain class or a culture. And maybe that was unique to me because I was an expatriate.
Right.
But I certainly felt like I could be whoever I wanted to be at that age. And so, you know, as you're developing those formative years, it was actually really liberating.
Yeah.
And so I didn't feel like I was being molded into a certain kind of person or type. It just enabled me to be much more freer and discover it on my own terms.
Sure.
You know, which was really exciting.
And what were you doing there? I mean, what were your, I guess your parents were there, or?
Yeah, my dad was my dad's still there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah, he lives on a boat.
Wow.
And he actually travels between Australia and Papua New Guinea, but he's a civil engineer. I mean, he started out as a civil engineer and went over there to build roads and bridges and do infrastructure. As the country was developing, and he was a very busy time in Papua New Guinea in the sort of late 70s and early 80s, and he's been there for over 30 years now, 40 something years, and And I've been, I did go back and forth quite a bit, but I haven't been there for a long time. I'd love to go back and visit it and see how things have changed, because I've got a kind of fixed memory of it in my head.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's a lot different, or maybe not.
Yeah, I was actually born in Cairo.
Right.
So, wow. And I have a very, very vivid memory at that time. And it was, you know, it was interesting because when I left Cairo and I was 6 years old, mm-hmm. It was 7 million people in Cairo. And then I went back to visit when I was 16 and it was 14 million people. And Wow. Now it's 28 million people. So,
yeah.
So it's a kind of a big deal how it's changed. But I had very, very vivid memories of Cairo and about a different, not dissimilar to you, but it's different in the sense that it was a different social aspect of mm-hmm. things, right? You know, there's a class system that's been there for 5,000 years.
Exactly, yeah.
And I understood that. And then, you know, from an American point, I was like, oh, there should be no class. It's like, no, you can't dismiss a class system that's been there for 5,000 years.
Yeah.
That system works for a reason. And you can't just say, you know, oh, well, you know, you should get rid of classes. That's not going to work there. Yeah. Same thing like in India, you know, you can't necessarily dismantle a society that's been bred that way. But that's a very well-formed society. I'm sure Papua New Guinea is actually not well-formed. It's very different.
Well, it does have a structure, but it's very tribal.
Right.
And so it tends to be, in some ways, a sort of simplified version of those things. I mean, you know, the conflicts are still essentially the same, mm-hmm. you know, at any level.
Right.
It's sort of human nature.
Sure.
But I think it comes down to a simpler and smaller kind of scale in a tribal system. But, you know, there's something really compelling about being around that and seeing in some ways kind of like the roots of civilization, you know, and getting some insight into how things are formed. I mean, they still believe in sorcery in some places in Papua New Guinea. So, and one of the things that has like a cargo cult where people who weren't exposed to the outside world and living in a village would see planes going over the top, and they believed that they were gods bringing them goods like cars and things.
Right.
So there was this, you know, that sort of clash between a very primitive culture and the modern world was something that was really fascinating to mm-hmm. be a part of.
Yeah, yeah. And do you feel that, I mean, obviously it was on your IMDb page, but do you feel that it influenced what you became later on in life, or?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think, as I said, there were formative years, and I think being an expatriate was, in a way, puts you in a position where you can sort of, in some ways, be an observer and a participant. It's just a funny kind of balance that mm-hmm. you have. And so in a lot of ways, you have a different perspective on human nature and human condition. You know,
right.
you kind of, it opens up your views to a wider, you know, broader kind of perspective of the world, and a sense of adventure and you know, wanting to be a part of that and wanting to know more. And I guess in a way that's my kind of driving creative thirst is for, you know, storytelling and discovery and wanting to explore kind of new worlds. And so in making films and working on things like visual effects, you know, that gives you an opportunity to explore and discover worlds and even create worlds. So
sure.
I think in some ways, you know, it's a pretty long bow to shoot, but I think the connection between that experience and seeing the world in a different way has sort of driven me into a really curious mind, you know.
Well, how did you start getting into either visual? Did you start doing visual effects first and then filmmaking, or was it sort of happening all at the same time in your mind in terms of what your interests
well,
were?
I mean, the evolution for me started, I mean, I was always interested in drawing and always interested in movies particularly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being in Papua New Guinea, one of the unique things was that we didn't have TV. And
right.
so, you know, we'd drive past a market, you know, where they were selling, you know, they'd have livestock and other things that they'd be selling. And it'd be just, as you imagine, a kind of very traditional village market.
Mm-hmm.
And then they introduced a television, and the television was in a caged box you know, about 15 feet above the ground, and there was literally thousands of people watching this tiny little screen behind this grill. And it was a very sort of unique, you know, entry into media in a way for me, because I sort of shared that experience. That was my first perspective of television as well. And, you know, we ended up getting a TV, but there was no real broadcast, so they only had videos.
Right.
And I remember the first time I watched TV, and it's probably not unique, but I walked around the back of the television to wonder, where are these pictures coming from? This must be a window into some other world. Like, well, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of naive interpretation of that. It's funny now, because I was talking to someone the other day about VR, and there's sort of similarities to that. I think when people put on a VR headset, they kind of like have that experience of like, wow, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. And that moment of like suspension of disbelief, you know, where you're like, oh, this is, I'm in a new world sort of thing. How is this happening?
Right.
But anyway, I guess that's how it started. And I was always fascinated with drawing and other things, so I spent a lot of time doing that. But then when I finished high school, I studied architecture.
Like a lot of us.
Yeah, exactly. There's many architectural students who become everything but architects.
Right. But I, you know, the thing about architecture school and even just the architectural education is that it's an amazingly powerful way to learn things. And a very, what I think one of the best things I've learned from it is it, you're very good at taking critiques and taking
100%
and that understanding what, how to improve yourself.
It's pretty much like American Idol every week. You know, you got to get up, you got to perform, and then someone is going to get out a cat of nine tails and cut you to pieces, and then you got to come back next week and do it all again.
And you just got to, you know, and I compare the critiques that go on architecture school compared to art school, because I was an art major and undergraduate, and art school critiques are like group therapy. So tell me, this is about your mother. You know, it's like, okay. And then architecture school is like, this is shit.
Exactly.
And you have to be able to take that and not just get upset about it, not get emotional and just.
It's good discipline, right? I mean, there's a utilitarian kind of value in architecture. I mean, it has to be functional.
Right.
So, and in a way, I think, you know, that part of filmmaking has taken a lot longer for me to learn, because in many ways, the process of making films, especially story development, is a singular kind of like solo activity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to get that level of critique that you would get at a university or school, right? But it still needs to be function, right?
You need to be able
to have a story that people can actually understand, engage with, and has some kind of like human relevance.
Right.
I think that's the big challenge for stories. But I agree with you. I think architecture was incredibly, you know, informative and build a whole bunch of foundations for me in terms of the way I work. I mean, the sort of management of a project, the discipline aspect, and the evolution of you know, a concept through to, you know, something that's complete. In many ways, it relates to a lot of the work that we do in visual effects and TV and film and other things. You know, you start off with a blueprint, and you have to sort of, you know, bit by bit, you've got to build this thing into a kind of house, you know?
Yeah. And so, I think also there's a lot of storytelling that goes on in architecture as well. Because as you give your presentation, you have to narrate what happens when in this building, you know, why you would be here and what you do here. So, you know, he's almost like when you present, he's like, so you walk in the building here and you do this and there's this thing and then this is the area. So you're telling stories as you're describing that.
I mean, it's a very abstract, like if you boil down the abstract nature of visual effects and films, it is about connecting with humans, and essentially architecture does the same thing.
Right.
You know, really, a building should communicate with its occupants. And so I think there's definitely parallels there. And you know, for me, it was very tough. You know, the 7 years I spent doing architecture, and I worked in the industry, and I worked on you know, Olympic stadiums and everything from that down to. You know, high rises in Asia and
where were you working?
I was working in Australia. I was working largely for a company called Philip Cox, and they did a lot of the development for the for the Sydney Olympics stadium and other things. And a lot of Asian high-rise developments and master planning, but also worked on you know, even down to small renovations for houses. So I kind of got a taste of everything.
Is that how you got into 3D, through architecture?
That was a big part of it. You know, at university, there was, you know, AutoCAD was really taking off, and 3D Studio wasn't readily available, but there was, you know, means to get it.
Sure.
The challenge at that time, which is very different to what it's like now, was that the university wasn't really comfortable endorsing, you know, the computer graphics approach. There was a kind of legacy mentality, and they were still very connected to drawing and using pencils and keeping it in the way that it had been done for you know, since the dawn of architectural conception.
Yep.
So they didn't actually even have a course for AutoCAD or anything. So everything that we did, I mean, there was only a few of us that ventured off into that arena, but we had to be self-taught. Mm-hmm. So while we're doing architecture, which was an incredibly demanding course, and working, we would have to sort of find time to learn the software. And that's when I made a short film, which was the very first CG that I did, which was involved sushi.
Okay.
And it was this sushi that came to life, and you know, they were sort of a bit like Fantasia, and you'd have you know, like a tuna sushi stuck on a set of chopsticks for legs, and right. You know, walking along and stuff like that. So there was all that. What was nice about it was when you're learning the software, you have that moment of like discovering that you can create something and bring life to it, and animation and all the excitement that comes with that.
Sure.
And so that was sort of a bridge for me, you know, going out of like building stadiums and other things in 3D and using it as a design tool to actually then you know, having movement and being able to create more sort of organic shapes and animation and then actually get to tell a story. Mm-hmm. You know, that was something that I really sort of exploded in my sort of creative energy and made me want to pursue it further. So I spent an awful amount of time, like many people who are learning software, you know,
mm-hmm.
Just diving in and trying every possible thing I could to you know, get the skills that I needed to take it further.
Right, right. And how did you go from there to sort of directing and writing and producing Fu and Taka?
Well, I did architecture for 7 years and made the short film in animation, which was a sushi film. And then that project went to around the sort of festivals and got a lot of attention. And I won a prize in London for the European Junior Animators Competition.
Oh, that's great. What year was this?
It's a good question. I think it was like 1998.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There. Yes, it was a while ago. And so I went to London and wanted to pursue more, you know, visual effects and had an experience as well
mm-hmm.
of living in London. So we moved over there and I did a course at Metro Screen New Media in, I think it was in Hackney. And I learned Softimage there,
mm-hmm.
and that was great because there was a whole different kind of aspect of animation yep. as well. So I developed more animation skills. And then I spent a year there working in various places, and then I came back to Australia and I got a job at Animalogic.
Oh, okay.
And that was really the bridging gap for me between architecture. That was when I was like, okay, architecture's behind me now and
right.
my future's with visual effects.
Yeah, once you start making films, it's a little hard to go
yeah,
back.
Exactly. So I was very fortunate to get onto a show called Farscape, which which was fantastic. You know, we did there was 4 seasons of that TV show, mm-hmm. and it was kind of a young animator's dream to be, working on spaceships and blowing things up and aliens and being out of space. It was a fantastic launch pad for me into the industry. But also my experience in architecture sort of came to bear as well in terms of managing the team, and very, very quickly became a supervisor. And one of the great things about that project was that there was a lot of artists who were self-taught, and many of them, this was their first TV series opportunity. And so it became a real kind of nexus of ideas and sharing and learning. And that team was incredibly strong, and really those relationships remain today with those people. And that knowledge sharing, I think, is a huge part of visual effects that makes the industry so unique.
Right.
There's this willingness to share ideas and techniques, freely. And that's just, it's kind of like the open source nature of what we do, right?
Right.
It's not something that there's this sort of protective thing about a knowledge base. It's really about sharing it and growing the industry and growing the technology in many ways and mm-hmm. making things better always.
Right.
It seems like a very driving, sort of passionate part of what we do. So that was a great place to be a part of. And in many ways, it was like going to university.
Okay.
It was like doing a master's degree in animation, doing that TV series, because we all learn so much.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And so that was your time at Animalogic, but you continued there for a little bit, didn't you?
I was at Animalogic, and then I made another film there because I was very eager to sort of explore my skills in storytelling and go beyond kind of just shot development.
Okay.
And see what it was like. I mean, I learned a lot about directing and other things by being on set on Farscape and working with directors and reading scripts and breaking down, the visual effects content. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to explore some of those options for myself, and I made a short film and that had some success as well. That got onto the Shots reel, which is, one of the big commercial Shots is a commercial director's kind of showcase.
Okay.
And so, every year they get a bunch of directors that they think have a unique talent or a unique set of skills, and they showcase their work, and I was fortunate enough to be one of those people. And that sort of launched me off into greater interest in storytelling and directing, really. And so I applied to film school at AFTERS, which is Australian Film, Television, Radio School.
Okay.
And it was very competitive in those days. They had only 4 places for directors, and there was hundreds of applicants. And I was very lucky to get in and had an opportunity to do an interview, which was a day's interview with the staff and mm-hmm. and the lecturers. And it was a pretty intensive day where you had to direct actors in 2 scenes. You had to write a short film. You had to do interpretations of music into some narrative form.
Sure.
You had to present to a panel and go over things. But again, my architectural experience really sort of helped me out there, and I was very used to that.
Yeah, it's amazing how that comes back to you sometimes. Even though you practiced architecture for a little bit, which also helps.
Yeah.
But I really always look back to my architecture years in fondness, and it was like, well, why'd you give up architecture? It's like, I didn't really give it up. I'm just still using what
I
learned.
Well, it's an evolution, right?
Right.
Everything that you do in some ways, if you're fortunate enough, there's this sort of building blocks. And I think, it's not a linear path. I think it's more interesting if there is these kind of, little zigzags on the road.
Right.
Because you have a broader experience, and that brings a lot to bear in the work that you do and gives you a broader perspective. But anyway, I got into film school, and I was there for 2 years and did my master's in directing. And, that was a great experience. I got to work with excellent actors and amazing directors, and very fortunate. We got to meet the likes of Jane Campion and really get an insight into filmmaking process. And so that's where, my the convergence of my visual effects experience and, you know, working with actors and building a narrative kind of overlapped, and I felt like that was you know, again, another sort of bridge on the road, you right. know, to where I'm, what I'm doing now.
Okay. And then is that when you started to work on some other shorts on your own after you went to director school? Or
yeah, I mean, part of film school is making short films.
Sure.
But I would say that if anyone's going to film school, you know, the one piece of advice I would give them is that don't go to film school thinking that you're going to make the best film on the planet.
No.
The intention of film school is for you to actually make a bunch of shitty films.
Right.
That people – you know, you have to break a whole bunch of eggs,
right?
And it's geared for a learning experience,
right?
So they force you to in many ways to make a bad film so that you learn from the experience.
Yep.
And so when I was there, I found that really frustrating and painful. But in hindsight, it was absolutely the best way to do it. And in many ways, again, it's sort of like architecture where you turn up and they just force you into these directions to really stress you and make you bend into areas and feel the pain so you learn from it. And
right.
and that was a big part of film school. You know, there's a lot of pressure on people when they go and do these courses to make something that's amazing and award-winning.
Sure.
But often it's the people who had a lot of trips along the way that come out with the greatest amount of knowledge. You know, there's natural talent, but then there's, you know, there's definitely a need for learning. But I made a bunch of films there, and then when I finished film school, I went into commercial directing very quickly.
Oh, cool.
And
in Australia?
In Australia, yeah. I was actually approached before I even went to film school to join a couple of companies based on the short film that I did and you know, being on the Shots showcase.
Uh-huh.
But I really wanted to go through film school and have that experience. And so it was after film school that I decided to take it up. And then while I was doing commercials, you know, there's a lot of learning to do there as well. You know, you really are sort of sharpening your skills and learning your craft. And again, there's this real discipline because, you know, there's very set outcomes and, you know, there's a lot to learn from that. And so I applied that knowledge into making films, and then you know I made a couple of films that were more sort of narrative based with actors and focused on performance. And then I decided that I was ready to sort of make a film that I felt was a combination of all the experiences that I'd had and you know a combination of visual effects purely for storytelling purpose. And something that had, you know, a narrative that had meaning in it, and also, you know, I started to develop a focus on comedy. So all of those elements came together, and I was able to do Fugu and Taco, which was a film that I started out my very first film that I did in visual effects was a sushi film,
right? And that was kind of your inspiration, right?
Yeah, it stayed with me, and. And I remember, you know, thinking I was in a sushi restaurant, and I was thinking while I was eating the sushi, I could see there was a tank full of live fish, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I felt a bit guilty, you know, sitting there eating sushi with this tank of live fish there, and I thought, you know, it would be interesting to do a story about someone who ate a live fish, like a whole live fish, and then it just sort of grew from there, and that's where it kind of started. And that with the you know the earlier sushi film that I made, and so I pursued it in a script form, and then you know I had my own company by this stage doing visual effects, and I was a director at Radical Media, and you know everything was going great in terms of. You know, we had a huge amount of work and we were doing a very high standard of work. You know, so I'd sort of reached the peak of what I could do as a visual effects artist and having my own company. It was
But you had fantastic. A visual effects background, so knowing what you had to accomplish as a visual effects, you kind of had that figured
yeah,
out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, what enabled me to do the film in some ways, because, you know, it can be an expensive exercise, was sure. that I was a commercial director and had my own company. So I was able to do it at a certain standard, you know, mm-hmm. without any other support. It was, you know, it's just largely financed by me And I'd done some commercials, which I, you know, the profit from those went to making the film. And you're right, making a film with visual effects knowledge is, especially when you've got lots of visual effects, you know, it is an asset. You know, one thing that I think that is a challenge for people who are in visual effects and making films is that, you know, the story is always the primary goal. You need to be able to tell a great story and have a connection with some kind of human condition. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that gets a little lost because there's this kind of obsession with wanting to make the visual effects look great and obsession with all these cool-looking shots. And
right.
They don't necessarily serve the story. But for me, you know, my experience at film school and I guess the sort of films that I enjoy the most are films that sort of move you and connect you with these human experiences and tell a good story. So the visual effects was only a way to communicate the idea. I mean, uniquely in Fuguntaka, though, they are a huge part of the project.
Sure. You've got two main characters.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly. But the story, you know, wouldn't really survive without them, and that was kind of critical. You know?
Right.
In some visual effects films you can watch, the story doesn't necessarily need to have those visual effects elements and it could still survive. So it's kind of like an efficiency, you know, in storytelling. It's one of the things you think about is how can I tell this story in the most efficient way, communicate the ideas I need to, and then when I am using visual effects, how can I make them as great as they can be for that singular purpose of telling story?
They have to serve the purpose.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, for Fuguntaka, we had a bare bones script that was about this guy who eats a puffer fish, and his head transforms into like a puffer fish like shape.
Right.
It's a bit like an X-Men mutant in some ways, and. And then he has to live with this sort of, you know, grotesque
condition.
Yeah, puffer fish head, and the consequences of that action. You know, we follow in a documentary kind of, you know, slice of life way, and that's something that really appeals to me too. Is creating visual effects in a very realistic and raw sort of setting,
right?
And making them a part of the world in a way that doesn't have, you know, too much spit and polish in terms of the filmmaking itself.
Right.
You know, films like District 9, I think, are great examples of that.
Yep.
You know, where it does feel really raw and visceral and just a part of the world and not something that's like a construct.
Right.
So that was a big appeal for me. And the film is starts out as a very straight kind of narrative, observational story of these guys in a sushi restaurant. And then when the guy eats the live pufferfish, it quickly transforms into this documentary about what it's like now that he's got this you know, fat pufferfish head.
Where did you film it?
We filmed it in Sydney. My wife was a producer. I was very busy on a commercial, and that commercial shifted its schedule. And she was tremendously, massive amount of effort from her to pull the project together. Since this other commercial had been delayed, so she produced it, she cast it, she found the locations, and did the wardrobe, and you know, pretty much did everything. And I just turned up on set and directed
really?
Actors. Yeah,
so wow, that sounds pretty great.
Yeah, it was kind of the best relationship. I don't know, maybe my married life's a bit like that too. You'd have to ask her.
Really? Yeah.
But we did film it in Sydney. The challenge was obviously to make it look very much like it was set in Tokyo.
Right. And your actors were Japanese?
Actors were Japanese. You know, a lot of people ask me, why are you doing a film in Japanese? You don't speak Japanese. That's insane. Right.
Did your actors speak Japanese? Only speak Japanese?
They speak English as well. But for me, it was really important, again, to create this sort of suspension of disbelief and make it very authentic, you know, as a documentary. And
so you didn't understand what they were saying.
Didn't understand what they were saying. So the casting process was interesting. But we found some fantastic talent. And for me, one of the big discoveries as a director, and I think this is the biggest thing that's really influenced me directing after I made the film, is that when I was on set, the actors were speaking Japanese. I allowed them to do lots of improvisation. We knew exactly what we needed to achieve in each scene. We wanted to create sort of emotional arcs, and I discovered that I didn't really have to listen to what they were saying. It was more about observing their performance.
Right.
And really feeling it and just sort of letting go of the script a bit.
Right.
And it's a bit like watching subtitles. And, you know, when you watch a film with subtitles in it, you don't necessarily catch every word in the subtitles, but you can follow the gist of the film.
Right.
And part of that is because you know what the emotional conflicts are.
Right.
Like the human condition.
Like 75% of the words are just in the face, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's remarkable how transparent the human condition is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at someone, you know when they're lying. You look at someone, you know if their heart's breaking. These, mm-hmm. these are kind of key things. And if the actor is
across doing, multiple cultures as well,
100%.
Right?
And that's the most compelling part. Not necessarily what they're saying, it's but how they feel
mm-hmm.
And then what they do about it. So for me, that was a huge turning point as a director. You know, I because prior to that, it was very much about, you know, this is the script, we've got to hit the script. And, you know,
sure.
I was always open to improvisation, but there's always this kind of like questioning and so much kind of like the mechanism of filmmaking gets in the way so much. And this experience actually sort of forced me to recognize the fact that I have to be an audience
right.
for this moment. You know, if everything else is kind of going crazy on set, there's lights, cameras, you know, massive crew. You know, there's lots of things to juggle. You're thinking about your next shot, the schedule, everything else. But when you sit down and you call action, you really have to take a moment to allow yourself to let all that go
and observe,
and just
it.
Be very present mm-hmm. and watch the movie.
Right.
And you know, that's something that I really had an acute awareness of on that project.
Well, it's interesting when you were talking about the fact that they were improvising here, speaking Japanese, you don't speak Japanese, but yet you could see so much of their emotion. I'm wondering if some of that also comes from your experience in Papua New Guinea, where there were so many different languages, you didn't necessarily understand what everyone was talking about. I wonder.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean,
you were able to communicate to a lot of people that you probably didn't have direct communication with. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, I've traveled around the world a lot and been to different places. And I think, you know, like we said, that human condition is there's a lot of universal values there that people can connect with.
Sure.
And I think, you know, that project was unique in that way. And I mean, I did have the benefit of talking to them after each take and them giving their interpretation of what they'd said.
Okay.
And it built a real trust, which was also another key thing. You know, when you're
right.
in collaboration.
Yeah, because if the actor feels it, you're giving them leeway, they feel more empowered to carry the performance.
Yeah. I mean, filmmaking is a collaborative process. And I think, you know, the best experiences for me have been when the collaboration has been strong and we've built trust with everybody that's worked on the project and hasn't become some kind of crazy dictatorship.
Right.
And I think people, you know, once they've got trust or feel as though they've earned trust, can really, you know, give their best work. And,
right.
And that's certainly true of actors. And that was certainly true in this case. I think, you know, I was very open to their input and the direction that they wanted to take their characters. And I think you really see the benefits of that in the film.
Right, right. And so when did you actually start shooting that and making that happen?
That film was made, where are we now? I think we filmed it, I think it was in 2011 or 2012. I think it was 2012 actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just before I came to the States.
Mm-hmm.
We made that film. We spent a long time developing the visual effects for it. It was a very low-tech shoot. One of the things that I do on set, especially if it's my own film, is try to reduce the technical burden on the filmmaking process and think of ways that we can shoot it and still enable us to get the effects that we need, but not to go kind of not to have the whole project or shoot being hijacked by the technical process.
Right.
Which can happen. You know, you can end up in like tracking marker hell.
Right.
You're waiting for somebody to set up green screens for every possible angle, and
yep.
and I think that's where the experience of being a visual effects artist and now director.
I think it's interesting because I think that part of what happens, you know, a lot of people don't, you know, people on set are not necessarily a fan of visual effects because it does do that. It stalls the process. Yeah. And they know something that's going on. But I think coming, being a director and knowing is like, you know what, I know how I'm going to do this. So I know what I need and how much I need to get out of the way. And a lot of VFX supervisors who are on set who are working with a team, then they don't know who the team is going to be. So they have to go for every possible condition of what they need. So that's why they do that.
Because 100%. I mean, everybody has to get their slice of time, right? And everyone is responsible for their role on set.
Right.
And it's very easy for a director to say, I don't care about that. We're doing it this way. And quite often it lands in the lap of the visual effects studio to sort of mop up the mess afterwards.
Right. I mean, I remember being a VFX supervisor for a show that I wasn't going to actually do the VFX on. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, I don't know how they're going to do it. So are we going to put tracking markers here? Are we going to put a green screen? And it's like, stop. We got like dead end HDR. You know, so I did everything that, and they probably used like 10% of what I gave them. Uh-huh. But I had to stop the entire process because in my mind, especially when things are shooting on set, you've got 5 minutes to make a decision that's going to affect months of work, you know, and it's always really like you say, well, I better make sure I get everything I have because this is my only chance.
Agree. And I think that's part of, you know, the benefit for me at least is that I have that visual effects knowledge. And so I know how to achieve things with a level of efficiency.
Right.
Not only in terms of saving time, but making space for actors so they can perform. And, you know, that's a really important part of it. And giving the cinematographer freedom to do what their instincts are telling them to do. So I think the partnership and this collaboration and trust is all part of it. You know, the more that you have experience working together with a team, the more knowledge you have, and the more I think a director is involved from beginning right through the conclusion of the project, there's a sense, there's a sort of burden of responsibility, right, that you're going to deliver the project.
Right.
And that's really important. And, you know, that's certainly the way I work. I don't think it's the way every director works. You know, some directors just go on set, especially in commercials, they go on set for, you know, 3 days, they shoot their stuff and then they walk off and go and do another project and then everyone else has to figure it out.
They get their paycheck and they're done.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you just get the plates and figure it out.
Yeah. That's precisely part of it. But I think Fugu, you know, was a very great project because we were fortunate enough to have all these people that were great collaborators and everything just sort of came together beautifully. And
we so had, you served as the VFX supervisor on it as well and just did did you have a team?
No, I had a visual effects supervisor on it from my company in Australia. And but I generally, and in many ways, you know, that collaboration between me as a director and them is important because I need to have some separation too, you know, as a director.
Because you want to be able to look at it with fresh eyes and not get involved in
and
minutia.
Just, you know, my focus needs to be on the performance and the story, not on, you know, where the tracking markers are going or whether we need a green screen or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if things come up and there's a challenge, I'm certainly there to help solve it.
Sure.
So, you know, once I've got what I need and my head's in the right place, I can always say, look, no, this is the best way to approach it. And it's a collaboration, you know. So
absolutely. I actually remember when I was at Method, I was working with one of our he was a VFX supervisor, but he was directing this particular spot. And he said, you'll be my VFX supervisor. But I knew him really well. And so he would do something shooting. He's like, Chris, you worry about this? Yeah, I got taken care of. So it was like we trusted each other. We knew where it was going.
Exactly.
And it was a very important thing. So I was like, he's focusing on the performance and he's making sure everything's going.
I think that's a culture that I'm certainly trying to change in visual effects on commercials and most of the projects that we make, is that there's this sort of tendency that the visual effects supervisor is somebody who is there to sort of service and, you know, stick up a chrome ball and do tracking markers and make everyone's day a nightmare.
Right.
Where the reality is it's a partnership. And in my mind, you know, the VFX supervisor is very much as important as the cinematographer. Those roles are the same in terms of my respect for those roles is identical.
Yep.
And you'll see, you know, projects like Gravity, where, you know, you have you have the visual effects supervisor, Tim, is in the same partnership with, you know, Chivo, the cinematographer, and the director. It's very much a triangle, you mm-hmm. know, and that was a very unique project.
The only way you're going to make that shot work.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that that's important on any project that has lots of visual effects. Mm-hmm. commercials, I think, are starting to get there, you know. I think film is, you know, probably already there in a lot of ways, but commercials, I think there's still this a little bit of a feeling that the visual effects is outside of the process.
Sure.
Certainly not on the projects that I do and that I direct, because we're so welded into the process that it becomes more of a hybrid, you know, production methodology.
Yeah.
As opposed to this sort of partition, it's like, okay, you do the front end and we're doing the back end.
Right.
You know, it's very much overlapped and seamless.
What I have found when I was doing commercial stuff, one of my favorite times is actually the bidding process. And here's why, because this is what usually, and you've probably experienced this very much so, but the bid comes in and say, here's a commercial, here's the boards, we want to do this. And you go back and you say, it's going to cost you, you know, $500,000 or whatever, because it's some crazy commercial. And they're like, we have 120, you know, and like, okay, that's not the end of the conversation. Because that's the best part, is that finding out, well, what do you really need? And then now all of a sudden, now you're having a dialogue with that director and you're coming up with creative ideas of how to cut budget. And then sometimes better ideas come out of that, even though they're going to be much cheaper. And like, oh, we can do this. Oh, yeah. And then you can just shoot this way. And then all of a sudden that thing whittles down to like 150 or whatever, and you guys make it work out or something of that nature. But what has happened in that process is you've already developed a relationship with the director.
Yeah.
It's no longer like, all right, here it is, $150,000, do whatever you need to do, and then we'll see you later. I mean, that doesn't work that way. You've already have this dialogue. So when you're shooting, you guys, you remember when we talked about that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So
I think that's a smart observation. And, you know, many times budget is a way into that conversation and that collaboration and partnership. I mean, it's great to have boundaries, right? You know, if you're in a box, you know, you got to figure out how you can use the resources you have.
I always find that if you have, you know, and no boundaries, it's very hard to be creative in a boundless situation.
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly how I approached the film for Guintaka was to set some boundaries. We had deadlines, we had goals, and we had, you know, a limited set of resources, and we had to use them really efficiently. You know, part of that was certainly on me because it was self-financed, and so there's another sort of driving factor to make sure that, you know, you get there on budget, because you're going to get hit with the cost. But that film has done enormously well. You know, it got picked up for broadcast rights, and
tell me about that.
Yeah, there's a number of TV stations around the world that have picked it up and in different regions, and so we couldn't distribute the film in its entirety online, and we're able to do festivals and other things. But you know, in my opinion now, short films, and in many ways all films, are destined for online. And
right.
And you know, it was an interesting kind of overlap, you know, coming out of Australia where there wasn't a lot of online. They didn't have Netflix there, right?
Right. They do now, though.
Yeah. and I moved to America and discovered Netflix, and you know, HBO is now, you know, on demand, and so there's this real movement towards online screening, and certainly you know, in the last few months I was able to release Fugu online, and I saw the difference between, you know, the 2 years that it had in broadcast and festival land, and what the, like, literally, when I released it online, the audience for that would have exceeded the audience for the TV.
It's amazing,
and, you know, by ten. I can't even imagine. It's exponential,
right?
And the feedback is direct, and you can really track all of that stuff and see where people are viewing your film, what people think of it, and having an audience engagement. You know, it's a big part of it. I mean, I made a film, went to Tropfest in Australia, which is a huge festival for short films. Mm-hmm. I think it was in 2004, mm-hmm. you know, I had the opportunity of seeing my film screened in front of, 100,000 people.
Wow.
And, you know, got up on stage and was able to talk about my film and really felt this, like, visceral reaction to the film that I'd made, which was awesome. And that's a really unique sort of screening experience. But I kind of feel the same now with Fugu and Chaka online, that there's this huge audience that has now seen it. And, you know, it's like 500,000 people have seen it in a matter of a week.
Yeah.
And that's a great feeling as a filmmaker, because you make films to connect with an audience. And if people enjoy the film and you're getting that kind of great feedback and that appreciation for the story that you made, I mean, that's the biggest reward.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it was, definitely a very interesting process to see how that went. But, and I think you're right. Online is going to be the way of the future. I think that there's a lot of things. I mean, personally, I hardly watch live TV ever.
Yeah.
Ever. It's like, it's a matter of, I can't make a choice. So I'm just going to turn on the TV and whatever's on is on. That's on a very rare occasion does that happen. You know, I just like, going to go to HBO Go. I'm going to go to Netflix. There's so much good content out there now that it's really up to, it's our power to choose what we really want to watch. We're not forced to watch Desperate Housewives of Atlanta, you know?
Exactly. Well, I mean, you know, like I said in the beginning, I grew up in many ways in an on-demand environment.
Right.
You know, I lived in Papua New Guinea. There was no TV and we had to put the video into the U-matic and press play. And so that was where my experience of watching films came from. And here we are many years later.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing. You know, I get
You're
to choose
making a
what
choice.
I want.
This is what I want to watch.
Yeah. It's not a passive audience anymore. You know, people get to choose. And I think, you know, that's what filmmakers, is a great thing for filmmakers, is that if you have the potential to get your project out there, and people can make a choice to want to see it. I mean, it's a word of mouth. You know, it's a big sea. You know, the big ocean, the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So, in some ways, it's hard to get traction, and there's a different kind of distribution and marketing model that's used for that. I mean, we have Fugu and Chaka on Kickstarter now.
Yeah, tell me about the Kickstarter project.
Well, the film was a great success, and in many ways. So it was the tip of the iceberg for us on these two characters and an origin story where you see these two guys go into a sushi restaurant and you know, have a meal, and by the end of it they've sort of mutated in an X-Men like way to become these sort of fish monsters, if you like, or fish men. You know, one has a big puffer head and the other one has an octopus like tentacle hand, and it's a story of friendship and a very unique one at that, but what I felt was great about the story was this sort of buddy relationship,
mm-hmm.
and this potential for them to take those mutations that they have further. And so now we have developed a graphic novel that we're working on. It's a 120-page novel that explores the two characters, you know, learning to use these new mutant skills that they have. And the story is largely about now that they've had this moment of fun and exploitation of their fishy features, that they've also experienced the bad side of it, and so they want to go back to being normal.
Sure.
And so they go back to the restaurant to try and discover how they might be able to do it with this chef that transformed them, and realize that and discover that he's no longer there. So. They go on this epic journey and they have to fight a legion of Yakuza and this like Godzilla.
So it becomes a Japanese road film.
Exactly. Like this Godzilla like mutant
and
it's epic proportions, you know, sort of a bit like the Adventures of Tintin in a way, you know. And so they go on this huge, huge journey and really discover something about their friendship and their abilities.
Right.
In an effort to try and go back to being normal.
And so the graphic novel, is that sort of a start for you to think about making a full feature idea?
Yeah,
I
think what's interesting is how do you – I mean, many people make short films and are able to make the bridge to a feature film. Quite often you need to have a script in your back pocket to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've certainly got that. But what's sort of compelling to me, and looking at things like Comic Con and doing research about comics, and I've always been interested in graphic novels, and you know, the Marvel experience is a great mm-hmm. great example of that transition from comics to the big screen.
Yep.
And creating a series almost, you know. that's what's interesting to me, is not just making the film, but what is the series?
Sure.
That's why we watch Netflix and download and just binge watch, you know, right. entire shows like House of Cards, is because right. we want to learn more about the characters and see this longer journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, you know, the evolution of seeing like comics and graphic novels go to the big screen is compelling and interesting. And I thought, well, you know, Fukuntaku is such a great story. I'd like to explore it in a comic and a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many people have said to me it makes perfect sense now that we're doing it.
Sure.
And we've had lots of support. And I think it's a great way to illustrate not only the story, but, you know, how it works visually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's essentially a storyboard for the bigger film.
Right.
And so that's a big driving force behind the project. But at the same time, we do want to make sure that the graphic novel is a success. You know, we have great people right. involved. We have Brad Vancato, who's a illustrator who's worked on Marvel, DC, you know, all the big comics, Dark Horse, all that stuff.
That's amazing.
And we have a fantastic concept artist, Jamie O'Hara from Framestore. He's designing the characters and creatures and
mm-hmm.
and building out some of the key frames for the different chapters in the story that will okay. have a very rich rendered kind of look to them. We also want to develop a VR experience,
really,
which will be, you know, a key frame from one of the big battle scenes that. A little bit like the Halo Believe project, where you saw that sort of maquette, you know, and seeing the sort of static frozen moment. It's a bit like that. So that'll be associated with the graphic novel. And so when you read the graphic novel, you'll be able to look through it, but then you'll be able to see one of these scenes in this sort of VR mode, mm-hmm. you know, either through an iPad or through, you know, Oculus or a mobile device. So
yeah, I just actually recently started playing around with just a Google Cardboard, and it's so easy.
Yeah.
It's like –
it's great.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, there's a whole bunch of – I mean, that's a formative medium, and I think this will be –
you could almost include like a Google Cardboard into the graphic novel.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's part of the plan, and it's just a unique way to sort of visualize the world that we're creating.
Right.
It'll be elevated in a way from the page, so it is more like a a keyframe from a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's sort of this bridging medium,
yep.
Which I think, you know, it's just all part of the bigger plan of making Fukuntaku, you know, either reach a big screen or have an extended story of some form.
Yeah.
You know, for me, the motivation for doing the next chapter is really the desire to tell the story of these two characters.
Right.
You know, I really got drawn to them when we made the film and you know, when I wrote the project initially. And now they were so much fun and they had such a – like there's this kind of very strong human connection with their friendship and their relationship and their exploits. They're a little bit like the Abbott and Costello, you know, this sort of odd couple.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're sort of given these sort of superpower abilities. You know, I'm really interested to see where we can take it.
Yeah. Well, that's really, really great. I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, are you going to – I mean, obviously – right now you're focusing on the graphic novel, but yeah. at some point you're going to start to think about where does it go next
from yeah. there. Well, I think you know, once we've done the graphic novel or once we get into the making of that, I think there's you know, like any film, I mean, I've pitched on some big feature film projects.
Yeah.
You know, I was pitching on one when I came to the States. I got invited as part of you know, the short film. Mm-hmm. It got seen by the studios. They really liked it. And so I was chosen to pitch on this project as a director, and you know, we worked on it for a few months, and so I know the process of what that is and how challenging that can be too in order to get a project up and running.
Yeah.
You know, there's no guarantees. I mean, in many ways, you know, filmmaking is an expensive hobby. So
yeah.
You know, you've got to love it. You've got to be really passionate about it.
And then you also have to find a group of people that you can work with constantly.
100%. Yeah. It's the collaboration's the key, and find people who believe in your work and believe in the story. You know, that is the most paramount part. If everyone believes in the story and can see it in their own minds, then you can build a great team and people are invested. You know? And largely the investment should be for the experience. We all want to sort of hit the big screen and have the project a success, there's no doubt about it. But for me, the experience is what I sort of take away from it. Telling the story and learning more about the process of directing and storytelling is the most satisfaction that I get.
Right. Well, is there any other big projects you're thinking on taking on as well, or is this focusing a lot of your energy at this point?
I work at Framestore and I'm creative director there, so we have there's an enormous amount of work.
That's on your day job.
exactly. Which is they're pretty long days.
Yeah,
and that's enormously satisfying. Because we get to work on some of the best commercials and projects that are available.
Right.
Framestore has extraordinary skills and a fantastic infrastructure and their visual effects credits are second to none. So
right.
It's great to be a part of that company. It's great to be in a leadership role with that company and to be able to influence our direction and our commitment to commercials and VR and films and all the mediums that we're exploring at the moment. It's very fertile ground at the moment. We're doing directing. There's we're doing our own productions. So there's this very hybrid model of production and storytelling across all of those formats.
Sure.
Which has become our focus. So my commitment is 100% to that at the moment, and Fugu and Taco is, like I said, it's kind of like the expensive hobby
right.
that I do on my downtime, but it also influences what I do at work.
Absolutely. I think there's cross learning that always happens.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's good to have that creative exploration,
mm-hmm.
Of your own. I think every artist would probably agree that having that exploration of your own idea helps you inform other people's ideas.
I've noticed a lot of people when they go in and they make they're frustrated with the decisions of a director or VFX artist or a supervisor or whatever. If they actually went in there and they tried to make their own, they'd start to understand that perspective a lot
that's
better.
Right.
And I think that's a big thing.
Like,
the more you do it yourself, it's like, oh, okay, that's why this was such a hard
thing.
Yeah.
I think that's really valuable. And It does make you have a new respect for people in the process.
Sure.
I've done a lot of different areas in filmmaking and visual effects, and I have so much respect for everybody and their role. That everyone's there for a reason, and each of those roles it requires enormous sort of creative and technical challenges and is very unique
right.
to their specific task. And I don't think you can ever undermine or underestimate their part to play in the bigger project.
Sure,
absolutely. So I think that's a very true statement. And again, I think the collaboration, if you have that respect for those people and each individual's role and what they contribute to a project, you really can have a great experience. It's mm-hmm. very liberating. You don't feel the burden of having to do everything yourself, right?
Yep.
It's such a great, great reward. And I think, there's many ways to do things. And one of the things that we did on Fugu and Taco, which was really unique, is we did all the animation in Houdini, which is
traditional animation pipeline.
No, I think most people don't really associate Houdini with anything but making explosions, fire, and water and
yep.
effects work. But it's a fantastic package for a whole range of reasons. But we really had a great experience as a sort of procedural workflow using.
And then how did you bring that? Let's just so some obviously there's a lot of technical people that are listening to this, but mm-hmm. you brought in your animation in Houdini, and then you translated that in order to render it in V-Ray. Is that correct?
We did all the animation and a lot of the procedural modeling, and. Effects work in Houdini, and then we did some testing on the lighting and look dev for the characters using Mantra,
mm-hmm.
But we just couldn't achieve the the subsurface look that we really wanted. And I've grown up on V-Ray and and I've used it in architectural renderings for many years. And so we decided that that was the way to go. And using the fast SSS was, it's quick, it was efficient, and it just very quick results in terms of the look. And so it was a quick decision to render everything out in V-Ray.
Right.
What we did was all the animation in Houdini we cached out. We brought that into 3D Studio Max and then did the lighting and rendering out of V-Ray. And all the comping was done in Nuke. And that was a really sort of seamless workflow.
It's interesting just to the fact that Houdini was your major factor in it, because that is, like you said, a different thing. Was that your choice to use Houdini, or have you been a Houdini fan for a while?
We were doing a lot of effects work in our commercials, and so that was our way of getting into Houdini. But then we discovered a whole other assets in the toolkit, which is the animation side and just the procedural nature of the way it works and the node flows and everything.
And it must have been similar to your background in Softimage as well, huh?
Yeah, a little bit. It's funny though, I think making the step from 3D Studio Max into Houdini was probably pretty easy.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of modular way of working, and the problem with 3D Studio Max for us was that, and as a company, I think, was that it's very much a plug-in based tool. So, right. You partition your resources a lot.
Right.
And so you have to buy all these sort of plugins, and it ends up being
very expensive.
Expensive, but also not everything talks to each other as efficiently as you'd hope. And so that was what drove us to Houdini was, everything was integrated. And so all of your data sets would just communicate. Right. And it was very procedural. And so, to influence change, it was really quick. The scene building is, extremely efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And it's built up for a kind of modular way of working. So you can, you reach a point in the process, like the animation is finished, you bake it out, and then you bring it in.
Right.
Having that really informed our sort of pipeline and enabled us in some ways to just, export what we needed and then render it in Max without any problem.
Yeah.
It was just develop the shaders in V-Ray, away we go. But as I said, I think, V-Ray was for Houdini, we would have loved it.
Yeah. Your wish may be coming at some point. We're working on something of that nature. We presented something a month or two ago about V-Ray App SDK and how we're trying to bring it in to make that work with Houdini. So there's actually efforts to be trying that out for good reason. I think there's an audience that it really would like to be able to have additional rendering support into Houdini. So so we'll see. And when we start using this and start doing things, I'd love it to put it in front of you and say, hey, here you go. This is what you've asked for. What do you think? so that you can give us the feedback. It's like, let's make it do this, or I need it to do that. Because, the best way to try software is to use it in some kind of a production of some kind of thing to just
absolutely
bang it out. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, one of the great things about V-Ray is its ability to be very efficient with resources, but also the way that it handles, large data sets and interior environments and things like that.
Well, it's the only way you're going to be able to bounce that much light around is if you basically use some kind of a cache or something like that.
I think that's a big part of it. And I think if it was available for Houdini, I think there is potentially a migration tool for that product as well, because of the way that it does scene building is extremely efficient and can handle big data sets. And if you set up, procedural aspects to the rendering process that's associated with Houdini, then, you've got a pretty solid, package between your scene building and rendering solution.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, definitely, we're gonna continue this conversation. with or without microphones, but I want to be able to figure out where you're doing and where we could fit in and where we can try to help you out and do different things, because I think you've already approached it, the idea that you want to try different things, different ideas, and, mm-hmm. and how you want to approach things. And that's really a lot of what we try to do at Labs. So it'd be really cool to be able to do that.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I mean, yeah. I think it's a great venture, the idea of setting up a kind of lab for creative exploration and, you know, some technical sort of road testing, I think is an exciting for me and certainly a great way for us to develop products and stories moving forward.
For sure. All right. Well, we're gonna let the last bucket drop, which is our sign off for the show. And thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
No, thanks, Chris.